the entire...
Yeah, the students are now raining bottles down. Now, this is unfortunate. This is going to delay the game. That's the student section down there in the corner. They're not going to win the Taco Bell contest at this rate.
No.
Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
People throw a bottle and it gets on the field. Like, half of them don't make it.
Russ Dillinger.
Grandpa's got a story.
And SI's Pat Forty.
Put your name in the books alongside Elmer Oliphant. You have done something.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod. Georgia, 30. Texas, 15. Death of the Dogs, premature. Show of force down there in Austin. Ross Dellinger was there. Let's start with what you think of Georgia. There's three stories here. Georgia, Texas, and all the other mayhem. But let's start with Georgia. If you don't do a good job, I'm going to throw a bunch of bottles onto the floor of the pod, and I'm going to switch to Pat.
Well, I'm on 2 hours of sleep, okay. So prepare for the worst.
We don't want to know about your nightlife or what you did after the game.
There was no nightlife.
Good. I don't want...
The game, I got to bed at 2 a.m. and 7 a.m. flight.
Yeah,
get out of here.
Sucks, man. Those night games are killer. Bulldogs, what do you think? Little old Georgia. Little old Georgia, the doubted. Nobody believes in them. It's tough being plucky little Georgia.
I know. It was a show of force. The way the Georgia's defense played is the way that kind of we all expected Georgia to play this season, and it's something we didn't see. And maybe, you know, when you look deeper into it, maybe partly we didn't see it because they were fighting through injuries a lot, and they had virtually everybody kind of healthy and back in this game. And it sure seemed like it. It was an incredible dominating performance up front by Georgia's defensive line in the second level at linebacker. I mean, Jalen Walker, just an absolute incredible game. Three sacks, eight tackles, and he had most of that at halftime. It was incredible the way they pressured. We talked to Jalen Walker after the game, and he was talking about how they studied so much film on Quinn Ewers. They knew exactly when he felt pressure or where he felt pressure, where he always liked to escape and step up. And you could really tell. They knew exactly what he was going to do. And they were able to swat, I think, get three sack fumbles. Just an incredible day for them. They had seven sacks, Dan. I put this in my story yesterday. Seven sacks. It was Georgia had last night. One of two teams in the last 20 years to have seven sacks against an AP number one ranked team. The other, South Carolina, in 2010. I think against Alabama, maybe.
Yeah. Would have been.
But just an incredible performance by Georgia. Kind of overshadowed by some of the things we'll get to next. But the Bulldogs defense, when they are healthy, they are real, and they are not just at-large playoff contender. They are SEC championship and national championship contender.
If I were Georgia, I would pay whatever it would take to find the world's leading exorcist and just get Alabama out of their soul, out of their psyche, and out of their system, because that's the only team that beats Georgia. They show up against other good teams and they kill them. I mean, they killed Clemson to start the season, and then the bomb they dropped on Texas, my goodness. They were laying for them. They were ready, as Ross said, and they just jumped them and totally, like, demoralized, bamboozled, confused the Longhorns offense. You know, to the point where you're benching Quinn Ewers and bringing in Arch Manning, and Arch had one scramble, and you're like, oh, here we go. And then, oh, no, they're going to strip fumble him, too. That was incredible. That was very impressive. And then things really started to turn against them strongly in the second half, but they had the wherewithal to to finish the game. You know, they made some plays to, you know, run out the clock there. Carson Beck had a very nice scramble. He had some really good plays on the hole on in the game. You know, they were not spectacular offensively, but give credit to Texas' defense for part of that. But, you know, I think you could tell they came in with a little bit of a little red ass, frankly, that, you know, they'd heard enough about Texas. Texas, number one, being an underdog. Texas sauntering into the league and all of a sudden ready to take over. Oh, no, no. The league still, other than Alabama, the league still goes through Georgia because that's a heck of a team. When, as Ross said, is that when they're healthy, they can just wreck you with that defense.
It really was it. This was Georgia. This lineman and that linebacker and this guy and that guy and who's this guy? And oh, my goodness, they just never stopped. Little passes out into the flats. Guy would just get his paw down. 7 sacks, as you mentioned. They terrorized 2 Longhorn quarterbacks. Oregon's number one, undefeated. Seems reasonable. Is Georgia really number one? I mean, it's a bad half against Bama. They overcame it. And then Ryan Williams makes that one incredible play. Is Georgia the team you fear the most if you're everybody else? Or, and I'm going to give it this, Carson Beck, 3 picks yesterday. Like, is there still some, and I'm talking, we're now deciphering between 1 and 2 and 3. Like, I'm not saying, oh, forget Georgia. I believe in you, Kirby. I believe you can win football games down there in Athens, Georgia. I think your little team there is going to be all right. But is Oregon should be number one. Congrats on the Ducks, first number one since 2012. But is Georgia that team again that you look and go, all right, this is the one that we thought was the favorite to win the national championship, and this is what they look like?
Yeah, I mean, I thought so, but, you know, this season's showing signs of
week to weekism,
you know. So, look, nobody's going to want to play them, but I will give the Ducks their due. I thought they played extremely well against Ohio State, and then I was impressed they backed it up and shut out Purdue. Purdue's terrible, but still, you go on the road, no letdown at all, and you handle the Boilermakers. So I'm not going to say this is that Georgia's the team to beat just yet, but that was the most impressive performance I've seen from anybody this year.
Well, and how about, well, you know, here we are talking about Oregon and Georgia, you know, and Oregon, of course, coached by Dan Lanning, Kirby Smart protege, and they've probably built their teams in a very similar fashion. Oregon, I think, has been built in a fashion that Georgia was built, and Georgia was built in the fashion that Alabama was built, of course. So I do, you know, the Pat mentioned the Purdue game. That had all the ingredients for the trap game. I mean, long road trip, Friday night kickoff, you know, bottom-dwelling team, emotional victory in a top-5 matchup the previous week. I mean, it all had the makings, and boom, they go out and get a first road shutout, I think, in over 30 years, and first shutout in like a decade, I believe. So you got to think that Oregon and Georgia, most people might say, are 1-2 right now. I've got Penn State 2, but there's an argument to be made for sure that we're looking at a Oregon, Georgia, and you kind of scratch your heads about the Alabama loss for Georgia, because we were sitting in the press or in the press box in the second half of the game Saturday, and a few of us reporters were discussing, gosh, when you look back at Georgia being down 20-0 to Alabama in the first half, and how the heck did that happen? And you know what kept coming back up, right, was, like Pat said, there's just something about Alabama in Kirby and in Georgia in general, and it'd be good for the Bulldogs if they just found a way to never play Alabama again.
Well, the good news for Georgia there is Alabama doesn't look like it's going to the SEC championship game and may not be going to the playoffs either.
Yeah, they may have been done. 13-12 over Kentucky, too, is the only other. So I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
right.
Know. It,
right
look, this right. is week to week. Everyone in the SEC's got a loss. This is the way it is. So there's going to be, they're going to be. And speaking of that is Texas. They come in riding high, number one. I mentioned they ain't played anybody with a good offense. Really haven't played anybody. Oklahoma, probably not a bowl team. Michigan, they still got Northwestern, and they better beat Michigan State this weekend, or they may not be a bowl team. Louisiana Monroe might be their best win. And so but they're riding high. Everyone's all excited. They look good. They got two QBs. They got all the stuff. They weren't ready for Georgia. And they mounted this comeback, but they didn't have enough. Georgia shut them down. This was a classic. Okay, you think you're ready. You're not ready. Maybe you get ready. Maybe you figure it out. Sarkisian pulls Quinn Ewers for a couple series, throws Arch Manning in. I was fine with it. You're trying to win the game. See if Arch can change the pace because Ewers is getting, he's not mobile. He's getting crushed, like Pat said. Then all of a sudden, well, they're getting Manning too. Then you come back to Ewers, which I thought was a good move. He says Quinn's our quarterback going forward, but a lot of questions on where this is going. And it's that quick. You go from number one and everyone loving you to everyone looking and going, you know, they haven't beat anybody any good. It's jerks like me pointing that out. Ross, how bad was this for Texas?
You guys remember, I know Pat probably definitely does because it involves Missouri. In 2012, Missouri's first year in the SEC, their first SEC game was hosting Georgia. It's this big game in Columbia, and there was build up for it all offseason. Missouri's first game in the SEC, and leading up to the week of the game, I think the Missouri players, and Missouri at the time, you know, played that spread, very spread offense and threw it around quite a bit. And Missouri players, one of them said that Georgia plays old man football, you know, the old man football. And Georgia came in and absolutely beat the hell out of them in that game, just in the same way that Georgia did to Texas. Dominated the front, harassed the quarterback, bunch of sacks, sack fumbles, including a sack fumble, I think, to end up securing that game in the second half back in 2012. And then after the game, Georgia said in the SEC, or a Georgia player said in the SEC, we don't play old man football, we play grown man football. And I don't know if these, you know, how much you can compare the Missouri team to the Texas team, but just Saturday night, it reminded me of that. And I was at that, covered that game. I was at that game in Missouri. And it did kind of feel like that. And you do wonder, you know, is Texas up front? This offensive line, I think, returned four or five starters. Supposed to be one of the best in the country, this Texas offensive line. And they were just eaten alive. And you just kind of wonder, you know, is the team kind of built on the lines for day in and day out of playing these type of teams in the league. Certainly that's kind of what you felt a little bit there. I was pretty surprised at how much they got beat up front, you know, and they got beat up front enough to where this game, you know, outside of that interception and all the penalty stuff that I'm sure we're going to get to, you know, if they don't have that, you know, the game's probably like, you know, 30-8 or 37-8. I mean, it's not anywhere close. And so I was certainly a little surprised by that, but it did remind me of that 2012 and another Georgia defense welcoming a league into the SEC, or welcoming a new team into the SEC.
Yeah. Well, Dan, I'm proud of you. You did exactly what I did in the 40-yard dash as an accomplished hater, veteran haters that we are. You go back and just start tearing apart Texas's schedule. Ain't beat nobody. Florida State is no good. This is the worst Michigan team since the 2020 pandemic debacle. UTSA is no good. Louisiana Monroe is Louisiana Monroe. Mississippi State is the worst team in the SEC, unless Oklahoma is the worst team in the SEC. Their first two SEC games, they're 2-0 there against bad teams. And they're used to playing Oklahoma from Big 12 days. So this was the real test of welcome to the SEC, and they got smoked. So you look at that resume, and it's a little thin. Like, if they get to two losses, I don't know what you do with that resume that's going to say, put us in the playoff. As it stands now, you know, if they go 11-1, if they go even 11-2 and get into the big the SEC championship game and lose that, you're probably going to get in. But if you go anything short of that, all of a sudden you're looking saying, who have they beaten?
Well, it's going to be
not many.
It's going to be a test. I think, you know, this will be a test on how the committee works. They're at Vanderbilt this weekend. We don't know whether what is Vanderbilt going to end up. I don't know. Okay, so it's not a pushover, but it's at Vandy. They're off. They get the Gators, looking resurgent, but still, Arkansas. Who the heck knows? Had their moments, but still, Kentucky, not great. Then they're at A&M. It's very possible that until they get to A&M, they don't really have a great win. And they're just beating the lower or mid-lower of the SEC. And you're going in and going, I got one quality win. And you lose that game and you don't get, you know, Aggies look pretty good, but they lost to Notre Dame, but they're 4-0. But that game could absolutely be a trip to Atlanta. Like, they kind of need to get to Atlanta. And this is the team we were talking about number one 24 hours ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's amazing, like, the way that the Michigan and Oklahoma wins have just lost currency. I mean, those two teams are falling apart, so.
We're not going to get, well, we might get to Michigan, but Michigan is, I mean, that's a bad football team. They just have no quarterback, zero. So. Jack Tuttle is from California. He will not be Tom Brady. I can now, I mentioned that. I feel.
Put to rest,
I
think
I feel pretty confident in that one.
Yeah.
I don't know who they beat. Like, they got Michigan State coming in. We'll talk about the Northern Egg Bowl later this week. But, I mean, they got to win that thing. I mean, they got they're going to beat Indiana. They're going to beat Oregon, Ohio State. This absolutely could be a 5-win Michigan team, national title to 5. And then it's going to be like, well, at least we're not at Florida State. That's about all they got. I don't know. And Oklahoma, we can get to them too. But all right. All the cans, all the bottles, everything. What kind of bottles were they throwing? Was it water bottles they were saying?
Well, it was a beer bottles. It was a nice mixture, Dan, of water bottles and beer bottles.
Okay.
Yeah, beer, aluminum beer, the aluminum beer bottles that they were selling in the stadium, plus the plastic water bottles. So it's a little mixture there, but that accounted for most of the debris on the field.
Okay, so this took on a massive life of its own. There was a lot of funny stuff. It was like Big 12 fans going, "Oh, things don't go Texas's way," so they pout and scream and throw bottles and claim it's unfair. And then still lose, get their way, and then lose. It was perfect. So the call was completely wrong, right? Jade Barron makes the interception, and then there's a flag down. It's called back. It's the wrong call. The Texas fans huck a bunch of crap on the field. It takes a while. They get the cheerleaders out there. They got a lot of people down there to clean up the bottles. Hope they recycle them. You get like ten cents in Michigan. Like, that's good money. It's college kids. They're rich as hell these days.
Put them in the back of the mail trucks like new.
Yeah, get them up to Michigan. You get 10 cents. 5 cents in Texas probably doesn't. You get 5 cents if you got to pay 5 cents to recycle them in Texas. I don't know what they got down there. It's probably a bad idea. I don't know. I don't make the policies. I'll take the 10 cents.
They discourage recycling.
Send the recycling to me. I get 10 cents out of it. Yeah. That's good for me.
Yeah.
Anyway, they get them all. And in the interim 7 minutes, the refs sit around and chat it up. Say, yeah, nah, it's a bad call. And they pick up the flag. Now, did they see the thing on the scoreboard? Were they influenced by, you know, the Sigma, the brothers from Sigma Alpha that hucking bottles at them and yelling, whatever. The call in the end got right. Everyone's mad. Terrible precedent. You don't want to delay the game. You want fans thinking, take more time to consider it, like throwing bottles at the jury and telling them to go back in and think some more. Ross, what the hell is going on? It's out of control down there.
It was, I've never seen anything like it, you know, in covering college athletic, covering football, like football in general, high school, pro, whatever. I've never seen anything like it. I've seen a reverse call, obviously, when the officials throw the flag and they huddle and then they announce there's no flag, actually, we conferred. Not throw the flag, negate a play, announce the penalty, mark the ball for Georgia for first down, and then there's a pause in the action, and the official who called the penalty is on the Texas sideline talking to a seething Steve Sarkisian, and then you can see that official run to the head referee while the bottles are coming down the field, and they confer during the pause, and then reverse the penalty. Never seen anything like it. We were in the press box like, wait, what? You know, what is going on? It was wild. It was wild. And you can imagine Kirby Smart was pretty ticked off. We asked him about it after the game in the news conference, and he went through some of the things that you've mentioned, right? The precedent that something like that would set. Hey, throw some things on the field, delay the game a little bit, give the officials time to think about it, and then maybe it goes your way. I will say one thing you couldn't see from TV that we saw in the stadium, they kept playing the play on the Jumbotron over and over, you know, and everybody in the stadium was seeing it. And Sark was pointing up at it and was right next to the official pointing up at it, you know, and so that was happening over and over again. And if you watch the play, clearly, it wasn't a good call. They were both jostling with each other, and it probably was a good no call at all. Like neither, I don't know if there needs to be a flag at all on that. There was contact by both, it seemed like. And it was wild. And there were some very angry, as you imagine, Georgia folks. The school president and the athletic director were on the field after the game. They didn't really comment. The AD did send out a tweet later, Josh Brooks, and about his thoughts. The school president and Greg Sankey talked on the field after the game. I saw them discussing it. So it is certainly seemed like an unprecedented situation. And really, the SEC's statement didn't give us a whole lot. Right. It didn't mention it said basically it said, hey, they cuddled and conferred, which is permissible. And the official acknowledged that he erred. But really what it didn't mention is that, well, the only reason they had time to discuss this is that there was a pause in the action to clean up the mess. And if they didn't have that pause, almost certainly the ball is snapped because they didn't confer until the stuff well into the 2 or 3 minutes into the stuff was thrown on the field. So this is a real issue. It is not over from the Georgia administration perspective. I think they want to see this addressed in some other ways. And I wonder, Dan, if it will be addressed with the officiating crew, will they suspend in some way the officiating crew? That has happened before. They don't publicly suspend officials, but they do suspend them.
I mean, they got the call right.
They did. Yeah. They did. But the way this happened, you just, I mean, like plain and simple, like you can't have that. You can't do that. You can't. Well,
fine Texas $250,000 for all those. I'd say you better drink them up to Michigan and get 10 cents because you're going to be broke. I don't know. I'm unmoved by the outrage. I get it. It was kind of what, Pat, I don't.
Yeah, oh boy, there's a lot here. The Texas fan reaction was atrocious and at the very least deserved the fine, if not a penalty at the time. And I will say I was very critical of Tennessee's fans when they threw stuff at Ole Miss. This was a little different. They like Lane Kiffin was hit by a golf ball and they had to evacuate the cheerleaders and band and stuff that was getting hit by debris
mustard
in the
bottle.
Tennessee thing.
Remember the
mustard bottle? Yeah. But this was still, this is bad. I mean, there's no excuse for that. None no excuse for fans to do that. And yes, if they've in any way incentivized fans to find a way to delay a game to put pressure on officials to change a call, that's very bad. That's very bad. So officials need to, but with the full backing of their conference office, not look at this and say, you know what? Yeah, if we're handed a bunch of time, we need to reverse a call. That said, you're right, Dan. That's the right, the justice, quote unquote, was served by Texas having the ball where they had it. But yeah, this thing where, as you said, Ross, I mean, they spotted the ball, like possession had changed hands. They spotted the ball. Georgia was ready to go, except for the fact that there's a damn riot going on. And so they had to take care of the riot and then get around to changing the call. So it's a bad situation for sure.
So all right. So what? Okay, let's take it. Let me go through this.
Let me just say something else real quick here. I would like to see Georgia's administrative energy on this be equaled by its response to their players constantly getting arrested. Okay,
fair point there. Yeah, fair point. Okay, so throwing the stuff is ridiculous because people throw a bottle and it gets on the field. Like half of them don't make it. There's like people in the third row getting beamed in the head by beer bottles.
Oh, they had some pretty good arms, Dan. There's a lot of things on that field.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of third, like the rest of the Mannings are up there. Maybe they should get him out in the field because nobody, Ewers was only 25 of 43, but the kid from the Alpha House. Don't throw bottles. You should get arrested for throwing a bottle indiscriminately down on a field. I would have absolutely no problem with that.
Yeah.
I get it. You're here to have fun. I'm not like arrest everyone who storms the field and stuff like that. But if you're taking a beer bottle and in a metal, they're metal obviously now, and you huck the thing, you have no idea who it's hitting.
Right.
So it's much like racing your car through the streets in the middle of the night. Or, you know, I mean, you could be totally arrested for it. So they could have gone in there and just wiped out the whole section there. So I'm not taking it lightly. I just don't know what, like, so because they rioted and then you realize this very key, potentially very key play in the game, you blew it. Do you want them to not correct it because of the reason for the delay?
No.
Like, is there an argument here without being like Texas didn't do nothing? I'm not saying that. That's what I'm asking. Like, I kind of at the end, I was like, well, this game, the best thing to happen to Georgia is they reverse this or Texas be whining forever that they were going to win the game.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Right. Well, it's true. Yeah, that's true. It's kind of like last year with the Michigan sign steal. Like, if it doesn't happen, if it doesn't get caught in the middle of the season, then the championship, right, is looked at differently. So I think the big issue here is when you announce the penalty and you mark it off and you're ready for play, you can't go back and you can't use the Jumbotron in the stadium to do it. You can't just have that. Like, that's a precedent that doesn't need to be set. No matter that things are thrown on the field like that, you just can't. You can't have that. I mean, we have review that has a structure and regulation and all that stuff. Like, you just can't. Oh, let me look at this Jumbotron. Hold on, let's announce the penalty, mark it off. But let me look at this Jumbotron. You know, you just
where the refs that's looking. Not where the refs
the
looking.
Way it should. It should go. Yeah, the refs I don't looking. Know. Yeah. So I think it would be different had they not announced it, right? They conferred before they announced it, which happens all the time. We see that a lot, but that's not what happened. And then it was also just like quadrupled in kind of drama with the things thrown on the field in the, it was about a 4.5 to 5 minute delay. And then when you see the video, that I believe was shared with the league office of the official who threw the flag, talking to Steve, a angry Steve Sarkisian, and then literally leaving his side and running to confer with the other officials. Not a great look, but I do understand the point, Dan. They They very likely got the call right, right? And yeah, it's a good point about, you know, this loss would have been looked at maybe differently if they didn't get the call right. And Texas folks would have been saying, see, you know, we could have made it a one score game, which they did. Of course, they ended up doing that. But if they hadn't gotten that opportunity and reversed the call, yeah, you could see this lingering. Also, if Texas somehow came back in the game, yeah. Holy cow, like this would be talked about for weeks in Athens, and it would in everywhere, maybe. It would kind of be the other way around.
That's a good point.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Playoff committee would have made it a factor, right? Bad calls by riot
control.
Yeah, riot control. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I will say that you mentioned, Ross, that they kept showing the play over and over, and I have seen this more in basketball than in football, where the home team gets a bad call and they will keep showing it to keep people booing to put the pressure on the refs, which I don't like. You know, I think that is like mob mentality of let's just gang up on the refs and try to get the rest of the calls our way. So I don't know whether that can be addressed, you know, at any point by the conferences of like, you know what, show the replay one time or whatever, and then move on. But that's I've seen that happen.
We'll be right back. Alabama, Tennessee. The other big SEC game, Tennessee 24, Alabama 17. This was a tractor pull for most of the game. Bad offenses, good defenses, though. I'll give it that. Tennessee's defense is legit, and they made Alabama, which scored all those points against Georgia, not look good at all. Second time in 3 years, second time since Alabama shows up in Neyland. Utter mayhem. Tennessee wins. First one was like an upset. This one was like, all right, we really can make the playoffs now. We had to have this. And especially on a night when, yeah, they weren't the best. Pat, you were in Knoxville. What happened to the goalpost? Did you end up in the Tennessee River?
A signal of partial program evolution there. They still felt the need to take down the goalposts and storm the field. But they didn't take them to the river, I don't think. I only actually tracked one of the goalposts, which actually didn't leave the stadium. You know, they never fully pulled it apart like a wishbone, you know, and had the separate pieces. So the other one, who knows? But it was a wild scene. Again, unbelievably loud in there. It's kind of hard to tell in that press box because it's closed in until, like, the ref's mic comes on. And then you're like, whoa, it is so loud down there. And the crowd definitely influenced some of the many penalties on Alabama, just, you know, getting them to false start and that sort of thing. So really big, big clutch win for Tennessee. And I was impressed with Tennessee's wherewithal because, as you mentioned, Dan, the game was really hot garbage for the first half. Even a little bit into the second half. But Tennessee hung in there. Nico Iamaleava was not very good in the first half at all, but he started making plays in the second half. They started getting a little bit of rhythm. They went tempo. They got things going. They ran the ball far better than Alabama did. And it was back and forth for a while, and then Alabama just spit the bit in the fourth quarter. Their offense was horrible. Their last four possessions, zero first downs. They just went three and out, three and out, three and out, interception. End the game. And so it was a very, very disappointing performance, I thought, from Alabama once they had gotten themselves in position to win the game. But a good performance by Tennessee. As you said, it was must win, really, almost either way. Alabama still does have a win against Georgia. And it beat the crap out of Wisconsin, and that win is looking better. But you're sitting on the bubble very much, and you're like tied for seventh, I think, right now in the SEC standings. So it is a very unfamiliar situation for Alabama to be in. And there's a real, I think, identity crisis going on right there within that program right now. I can talk a little bit more about that in a minute.
Gosh, when I was there 2 years ago, you know, when Tennessee upset Alabama, and I could hear from TV this game how incredibly loud it was in that stadium. It just came through from the TV. When Tennessee gets going, there is not a better place, atmosphere, and it is just unbelievable. And I'm sure, as Pat mentioned, that they really were the maybe the in the end were the difference maker in that game was the home field advantage. It was incredible. The thing that stuck out to me, I got to watch most of it in and out, but was how undisciplined Alabama is. And now we've seen this again, 15 penalties over 100 yards, I think, and silly penalties, right? Whether it's pre-snap or whether it's like a post-snap, like an unsportsmanlike, which happened, I think, on their last drive, right, Pat? They had an unsportsmanlike.
Kendrick Law, like, second to
we
last.
Saw it against Vanderbilt as well. I mean, and we saw it some maybe against South Carolina too. Like some of the things that we never saw in 15, 17 years under Nick Saban, boom, just a few months later after his retirement, we see in Alabama. And it does not bode well moving forward.
Yeah, 15 penalties for 115. I thought the call there on Kendrick Law, unsportsmanlike conduct in the final, whatever it was, few minutes of the game, it takes a 4th and 6 or 4th and 7 and makes it a 4th and 22. I mean, this is not the time now either player, really, because it was a little closer. They pick, but he just can't be involved where they're going to pick a side. I cannot imagine Nick Saban on that penalty. Kendrick Law should be quite happy that Nick Saban is not the coach at Alabama right now. You do that penalty. But I think the meltdown of Alabama fan, I really want to talk about Tennessee quickly because this is an incredible victory and another just great night for that program. But, you know, misery is always fun to talk about. And you guys will enjoy. I mean, Tennessee fans can enjoy Alabama misery. I mean, it's just and it's like this is the problem with following a legend is the lore. Like, no Alabama player ever committed a penalty in Nick Saban's years, right? I think there was like one false start in like 2018. I think that was it. It's only penalty. It's amazing stat. Like, no one ever lost their head. No one ever, but. Undisciplined, self-defeating. What is the offense at this point? Jalen Milroe, we were picking this game last week and we were all sitting there going, I don't know, dead heat, dead even, right? Neither one of us wanted to pick. And my thing was, you know what? Late in the game, I think Jalen Milroe will put together a drive. He had like 3 chances. He didn't go anywhere. What? This offense is supposed to be better with Kalen DeBoer. Jalen Milroe is going to be unleashed. They aren't unleashed. It was terrible. The only thing saving Alabama when you watched them was the Tennessee offense was much better. And credit to the Tennessee defense. It is excellent. Like, it is elite. They've got a lot of good football players. But it wasn't like they're driving down and there's a goal line stand. Alabama's just standing around. Like, somebody make a play to try to win this football game, and nobody is. Instead, they're doing the wrong thing. And, Cardiac Kalen, right? These games are going to be wild at the end. Well, you cannot have wild at the end in this. It's just got to be Paul.
Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. The Fun Bump Show would be something special this week, I'm sure.
Again, I mean, losing to Vandy is the ultimate. But when you follow that up with a shaky win against South Carolina and then this loss, they have not played. They played 14 straight shaky quarters, the last two against Georgia and every quarter since then. And you're right, Dan, there is definitely some revisionist history and some gilding of the lily. I remember talking on this very podcast, and I just looked it up. In 2021, Alabama was 12th out of 14 teams in the SEC in penalty yardage. In 2022, they were 13th out of 14. Last year, they got better. But this year they're back down there on their 15th out of 16. So there were a couple of years there where Alabama had issues with penalties, but the complete lack of composure to get those personal foul here and the one at the end of the Vanderbilt game, that was more just a temper tantrum. That game was over. But still, those are the kind of things where Saban puts a foot down and it doesn't happen, you know? So that's the difference there. And I think you're going to have to indulge me for a minute here. This is a first-person high school story, so it's not exactly apples to apples.
Pull up a chair.
Grandpa's got a story.
Grandpa 40 here.
You have one of them leather helmets Illinois wore the other day?
That's right. Yes, we did. We did. We didn't wear helmets, actually, so long of course. Ago. No. But no, my high school coach was Gary Barnett, who went on to fame and fortune, taking Northwestern to the Rose Bowl and Colorado to the Fiesta Bowl. And so we were extremely well coached in high school. It was Colorado Springs, Colorado. Like, we had elite coaching. That's why we won games. We were just better coached than everybody else. He left to go start his college career before my senior year. New coach comes in. He's a very accomplished coach. Knew what he was doing. We kind of bought in. We started off well. Won our first game. We're like ranked second in the state. And then we start losing. And it just went apart. Like, yeah, I'm not sure about this guy's play calling. You know, why do we do that in practice? And this, we thought we were bought in and we weren't bought in. New guy replacing a legend, and it was just didn't work. And I kind of get the feeling this might be the case here where they're, you know, yeah, I mean, DeBoer, he's good, but why are we doing it this way? Why aren't we doing it that way? Nick would never let us do that. You know, I just wonder if there's a little bit of splinter there from people that mean to try to do their best for each other, but it's just not happening.
You know, it's really going to be interesting and probably doesn't help Alabama and Kalen DeBoer at all is that Nick Saban every Saturday is the focal point in the morning to start and kick off college football. And he's going to have to talk, and he has talked in the past, but he's definitely going to have to talk now about why the program is where it is, having lost two games in its first seven for the first time since his first year in 2007. And that's going to be really interesting. You know, he's had a walk kind of a line, especially after the Vanderbilt loss, but now, right, coupled with this, it's going to be really fascinating to see what he says and how much he walks that line. He has, from what I could tell and have been told, he has stayed away. Nick Saban has mostly from the facility. You know, there it's not like he's walking the halls. He doesn't have an office right down the hall from Kalen. He's got an office across campus in the stadium. When he's there, you know, he's on the road a lot, especially with game day. But it's really going to be fascinating to see what he says about all this, especially about, you know, the undisciplined late game penalties, things that would certainly eat at him if he were coach. So that's going to be really interesting to listen to him this coming week and see what he has to say.
One place they're not worried about their new coach, Indiana Hoosiers. Good Lord. 56-7 on Nebraska. Game day is coming to Bloomington next week. Going to be without their quarterback. The whole thing's just rolling. It's great scene. There's nothing better than a new winner. And as they churn this up, you know, we were talking about it the whole time. Boy, they get to 9-0 in Michigan. Well, they get to 10-0 at Ohio State. How about this little bit? I believe this is true, right? Penn State, Oregon, and Indiana can all finish undefeated.
Yeah.
So one of them will not make the Big Ten championship game. Good league.
Gosh,
you got
your league might be too big.
But the possibility of Indiana at 10-0 against Ohio State, they could lose, end up 11-1 and probably be in. I don't know. They haven't, isn't a million great wins here, but it's there. But whatever. No one's having more fun than Indiana right now. And again, we'll see the Curtis Rourke injury and goes with that. But Pat, what's happening up the road there from you?
They have got the mojo. Incredibly impressive. Not just to beat down Nebraska. Nebraska team that people had started to warm up to as, you know, maybe they can contend. They were 5-1. But Curtis Rourke got hurt at the end of the first half. Taven Jackson, their backup, played the second half, and they still outscored him 28-0. Taven Jackson, this is yet another example of what an incredible job Kurt Cignetti did putting together this roster, is you kept a quality backup. You brought in a guy from the MAC to take the starting job, and you still kept a quality backup who started 3 or 4 games last year. And so now they can go into Washington on Saturday thinking, hey, we're okay at QB, even without our guy. So it's just unbelievable, the job. I don't know, Ross, you can correct me here, but has anybody in the transfer portal era put something together this quickly and just flipped it on a dime? Maybe Michigan State in 2021 when they went 11-2. But, I mean, it is so impressive what they've done. They're not just winning, they're dominating. They have yet to trail this season. And it's Indiana, you know? I mean, to do it there, fantastic.
Yeah, I can't remember, you know, when Brian Kelly took over LSU and when Lincoln Riley took over USC, you know, they lost, there was a lot of transition. They brought in a lot of transfer players, and they each made it to their respective conference championship game. Those two, and yeah, the Michigan State example, are the only three that probably compares, and probably pales in comparison, because I think he's done it in Indiana better than anybody. This is just an incredible stat here I've got from Max Olson of ESPN. These are the top five best scoring margins through 7 games since 2020. Number five is Georgia, 2021. Georgia's 2021 team.
Pretty good team.
Number four is Georgia's 2022 team. Number three is Michigan's 2023 team. Number two is Ohio State's 2022 team.
Yeah, pretty good team.
And number one is 2024 Indiana. They have scored more points, or they have beaten their opponents by more points, 245, than anyone through 7 games in the last 4 years. And yeah, you heard all those other programs. They were all playoff teams. And 3 of the 4 were national championship winning teams. So pretty remarkable what's going on there. And like Pat said, you know, they didn't need their starting quarterback to do it, which probably tells you a lot about the scheme and the coaching.
5 turnovers they forced, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. They got after Dylan Raiola. He had 4 of the turnovers.
Yeah. The other big one, Illinois, huge win, 21-7 over Michigan. Yeah, Michigan stinks, but who cares? Illinois, 6-1. 100th anniversary of Red Grange scoring 6 touchdowns against the Wolverines. Illinois hand paints every helmet to make it look like a leather helmet. I thought this was awesome. A lot of those throwback uniforms do not work. This one I thought was it was great.
It was remarkable. Yeah. It looked incredible.
It really did look like you're watching old-time football.
Yeah.
Fantastic job by Illinois. Yeah. And fantastic job by the team. Brett Bielema, he knows how to win Big Ten football games.
Sure does.
And that's what they're doing here. And Luke Altmaier throws a TD, runs for a TD. They just make enough plays, grind it out. Huge crowd, just amazing energy there. Like Big Ten power axis through the Champaign Bloomington corridor.
Champaign Bloomington Eugene
and state. Yeah, this is. I didn't, you know, 18 teams, I guess, yeah. But hey. Pretty awesome.
Your defense got to be playing pretty well if you win a game by 2 scores and your quarterback is 9 of 18, yeah, for 80 yards.
It was an ugly game.
Which Illinois was. Yeah, they played a really ugly game, and they won. And they played an ugly game against Penn State and lost at Penn State, which is their only loss so far. And if you look at Illinois' schedule, you know, they do have to go to Oregon this week, this coming week. But man, they could get this done. They could finish it like a 10-2 and be right there for an at-large berth, which is truly incredible. And it's a lot of the same way that we saw Brett Bielema win at Wisconsin. You know, it just, all of it feels very similar.
Illinois ran a fake punt at one point, snapped it to the up back, kind of a lumbering tight end. And in those uniforms, I thought, honest to God, like, where's Butkus? Like, forget Red Grange. This was so like throwback. The other thing, here's a stat for you on Michigan. I got to bury Michigan a little bit.
Oh, they're horrible.
They had 8 turnovers last year in 15 games. They have 15 turnovers in 7 games this year. They are a mess with the ball.
They do not have anything close to a quarterback. Like, I don't even know it's. They're supposedly making some massive offer to try to flip Bryce Underwood, the number one recruit in the country from Belleville, Michigan, from LSU to Michigan. They need to pile more on and somehow get him eligible as a high school senior right now.
Yeah. Get him in the Ryan Williams reclassification plan.
Reclassified right now. Welcome to the University of Michigan by Tuesday. Can you be here at 3:00?
We practice at 3:30.
I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if they'll make a bowl. They got to beat Michigan State. The quarterback play is just, it's unbelievably bad. They just, anything reasonable. If they could have had Cade McNamara stay, and I know Cade McNamara went up to Michigan State, who's looking pretty good.
Went to Iowa.
Yeah, but he went to Iowa, Iowa went to Michigan State.
Oh.
And I missed it, but he was at, they play Iowa, they lost at Michigan State this weekend. Michigan State's looking pretty good, but Cade McNamara is still better than what Michigan's got. So anyway, that's what that is. All right, USC, along with Texas, another of the petulants that wanted something new. 3-4. Blew another late one. I'm wondering whether the travel is there, the depth. I don't know. They had no business losing this game to Maryland. They did. And all credit to Maryland. Kept battling. Blocked a field goal. 2 late scores. They go for 2 early. Win it 29-28. Maryland needed a nice day. They needed something. Hasn't been the best season, but they got it. And USC is 3-4. Inexplicably with a victory over LSU. Okay. All the losses are pretty close and all that, and that's what they'll point to, but you're still 3-4. Lincoln Riley, heat check, heat lamp check. You got the old Trojans complaining, everyone. It's not pretty, Pat.
Oh, it's bad. It's bad. Yeah, it's every single one of their 4 losses, they had a lead in the fourth quarter and lost it. They have not been able to shut the door. And that's, their defense is still better than last year, but it's not better when they have to be to win a game. And the offense is worse because you've gone from Caleb Williams to Miller Moss. Miller Moss is pretty good, but you're just not as explosive offensively. So you need the defense to win some games for you. Need your special teams to make a field goal or not get one blocked or whatever. They're not doing that. The thing there, you're kind of stuck with each other, aren't you? Where's Lincoln Riley going to go? Like, the NFL's not going to hire this cat. His stock has done nothing but go down since his first year at USC. He's gone 11-3, 8-5, now 3-4, and who knows where this is going to end. But, hey, the revenue, but better revenue, more revenue. You're playing in College Park, Maryland. Your fans are like, what the hell are we doing here? You're playing in Minneapolis. Your fans are like, what is happening? Oh, we're losing. That's what you're doing. Giving up 2 touchdowns in the fourth quarter to Minnesota and 15 points in the fourth quarter to Maryland. Enjoy the checks. It's great.
They've lost to Michigan too. I mean, geez.
Yeah.
So they led 24-20 with a minute left with Michigan. They led 17-10 at Minnesota with 8 minutes left. They led 23-20. To Penn State with 11 minutes left. Of course, they led 20-6 in that game at one point, and they led 28-14 on Saturday with 11 minutes left. Remarkable. And I believe Lincoln Riley's quote when asked after the game why his team can't hold the lead was, I don't know. Lincoln Riley probably has a buyout estimated in the Jimbo Fisher range, by the way.
I just don't think, I think they're stuck with each other.
You remember last summer when Julian Lewis, the 4- or 5-star recruit quarterback, who's committed to USC, but still took a call, he went to Colorado, he took a visit to Indiana. We literally talked on this pod about like, hey, man, like, this is actually really good for Indiana. They're in on this kid. You know, it was unfathomable that someone would say, I'm a quarterback, national level quarterback recruit. I'm going to go to Indiana instead of USC. Try flipping that now, baby.
Yo.
Quickly, Big 12. We see you, Colorado. We see you, Cincinnati. We'll try to maybe get to you later. But BYU, the dream of an undefeated BYU versus undefeated Iowa State. It's still there, and they did it wild. Pat, you were right. Oklahoma State did cover on Friday night.
Yep.
But.
Gritty cover.
But 10 seconds left, and Jake Retzlaff, right? Retzlaff?
Yep.
35-yard touchdown pass to beat Oklahoma State 38-35. And then Iowa State goes 80 yards with no timeouts in the final. Actually, didn't even need it all. They score with 30 seconds. Rocco Becht with the clutch, two straight QB sneaks at the goal line and win the game, beat UCF, which included, UCF was a mess. UCF included a pick six that wasn't because the guy dropped the ball in the one.
Oh, that's right.
That one always hurts.
Yeah.
That's a tough flight home when you're the guy that just, because you had to celebrate.
Yeah.
But hooray, Ames. And
yeah,
Big 12, they're rolling 7-0, still going.
It's amazing. I mean, that's the happy, happy, joy, joy stories out there right now are Indiana, Army, Navy, and these two cats in the Big 12. It's amazing what they're doing. That, I thought Iowa State could have a pretty good year. I wasn't sold on BYU at all. And you still wonder if there's a little fool's gold with the fact that they did need to make these last-minute comebacks against not very good teams. But just keep winning, and it'll take care of itself. If both of these teams get to the Big 12 championship game, for sure the winner's going to the playoff. And if they're both 11-0, the loser's going to go too. So, or both 12-0. But a lot of football still to be played. Utah's on both schedules, and I know Utah's a bit of a mess right now, but I wouldn't want to deal with Kyle Whittingham in a spoiler situation. Iowa State closes the regular season against Kansas State. That'll be difficult. But all hail to both these teams. It's in that league, it's all week to week, but somehow they keep winning every week.
The standings in that league, I mean, you got them two at the top, obviously. And then you got four schools tied at 3-1. So you got really six teams right there that are in it here down the stretch. Kansas State, Texas Tech, Cincinnati, and Colorado all kind of bunched together. And many of these, because the conferences are so big now, many of these teams don't play each other. So if BYU and Iowa State were to stumble, boy, that could be interesting, all these tiebreakers. And the same thing goes for the SEC and in Big Ten and even the ACC. But I'm like, Patty, you kind of thought Iowa State was an 8-ish win team this year. You kind of thought BYU, I thought, maybe would struggle to make a bowl game. And here they are. It just great stories. And BYU's not, you know, they're not like top 20 in any major statistical category. They keep getting it done with the quarterback there, and both quarterbacks, kind of the engines of their team. The final drive, Rocco Becht, the final drive was sensational. Not just the sneaks, as Dan mentioned, but I think there was two or three throws under pressure he made. Perfect passes. Really, really spectacular. And yeah, it would be really fun if these two teams can win out and meet in the championship. And solidify or secure for the Big 12 two teams in the CFP.
Big 12 is a lot of fun. Another Friday night classic too. The Friday night games are just
doing well.
Yeah. Just perfect every week. That's been a huge addition. to what we're trying to accomplish here. And this Friday night, Boise State at UNLV.
Big one.
Absolute monster. UNLV big won. One. I was watching late Saturday night on the C-Dub. Like, it is great. Every ad is Blue Chew. I was like, oh, man. Like, how many ads? It was like, great. It's better. The games are better on these kind of rando networks. Don't give me any trouble with the CW. It's great. Game was good. UNLV, Oregon State went down the end. Might have been a pass interference. I don't know. But anyway, UNLV 6-1, Boise State 5-1. That'll be next week. All right. We'll be back with small sample Heisman. All right, this was obviously a loaded week, so we didn't even get to half the stuff we were supposed to get to. But fortunately, we have two more podcasts this week. So you should subscribe, share us on social media, and tell your friends about us. But we hand out the Heisman every week. We don't wait to the end. Get in the Heisman house. It's like an Airbnb. Quick trip. In and out. Got to check out. But who wins your small sample Heisman this week? Pat, Ross, anyone got on?
I got one here.
Okay,
go for it.
How about Missouri quarterback Brady Cook?
Ah, perfect.
He returned from the hospital to lead the Tigers to a victory over Auburn, a comeback victory over Auburn in incredible fashion. Missouri scored was behind 17-6 and. Scored a couple of touchdowns in the fourth quarter, field goal late in the third. But how about he was sent to the hospital and came back. It's the hospital. I would imagine that he was in the hospital. It's kind of across the street from the stadium there in Columbia. It's very close. Yeah. So it wasn't this big journey. But he talked about it afterward and was fascinating. He was in a truck with being taken to the hospital mid game, weaving around tailgaters. And I think he said something like, you know, the glances and looks he was getting from folks who were seeing their starting quarterback drive by in a truck mid-game. and then to come back and to lead Missouri to victory, pretty incredible. Missouri 6-1. They go to Alabama next week. Playoff hopes alive.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have believed that Missouri would be in better playoff shape than Alabama going into that game, but here we are. I'm going to go with – I'm sorry, I've done him before. I'm doing him again. Bryson Daly, my small-town Texas hard-ass quarterback for the Army Black Knights. Abernathy, Texas. 171 yards rushing on 31 carries, 5 touchdowns on the ground. He also threw for 147 yards, which is a lot for Army, and a touchdown. His 6 total touchdowns, the most at Army since like 1920-something by some dude named Elmer Oliphant. So when you put your name in the books alongside Elmer Oliphant, you have done something. Give Bryson Daly, Captain America, the small sample Heisman again.
I can't argue with that. I am going to give my small sample Heisman to, I might do 2. Don't hate me for it if I do 2. But I'm going to give it to Jonathan Kim. Start with him.
Oh, good one. Good one.
Michigan State place kicker. Jonathan Kim, he hit a, started the game 42-yard field goal. Then he hit a 43-yard field goal. Then he had a 36-yard field goal. Then he had a 29-yard field goal. Then he had a point after attempt converted. Then he had a 55-yard field goal. Then he had a 46-yard field goal. Then he had another point after converted. That's 6 field goals. That's 18. 2 more, 20. 20 points for a kicker. Michigan State, 32. Iowa, 20. There's a Brian Ferentz joke in there somewhere. He ain't even there anymore. Hell of a job when you hit all your kicks. 6 kicks. Michigan State, 4-3. Not bad. And they got Michigan coming up. One other thing on Cook at Missouri. Eli Drinkwitz said after the game, his quote, I mean, this should be carved to the side of the stadium. Why did he come back from the MRI at the hospital? I've only got 2.5 games left on Farrow Field. I'm not missing this one in the hospital.
Yeah,
Pat, you're a Missouri alum. Is that the best quote ever for Missouri?
It's you build a seventh column on the quad for that one. There's six columns up there. That's kind of the iconic thing. Build a seventh column for Brady Cook right there. Farrow Field, by the way, Dan.
Farrow Field. Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay. We get what we get with you, so we know. It's all right.
Yeah. My other small sample Heisman, Tawi Walker, running back for Wisconsin Badgers, Pat noted earlier, now 5-2. He had 126 yards, also caught 2 passes, and led bludgeoning of Northwestern. Sure is Northwestern, but you walk up to the side of Lake Michigan there and come a win. But Wisconsin's starting to figure some things out. Maybe they're figuring it out because they're playing with Northwestern, but we will see. So good job by Walker. All right, we've said a lot of mean things on here. Can we say something nice? Anyone got anything nice to say?
I say something nice, Dan. I have something nice, and we mentioned it a little bit, but I want to talk more about it. But Illinois' uniforms were just terrific, and I think they should get a little more time on the pod. They were throwbacks, of course, celebrating the 100-year anniversary of Red Grange scoring 6 TDs against Michigan. They wore them for, of course, the Michigan game, the Michigan win. And each helmet was individually spray-painted, like hand-painted with an airbrush that took a couple hours each by a man named Armando, who lives in Nebraska. He hand painted each of them, and then they had the uniforms to go with them, and they just looked spectacular. Just about as good of throwback uniforms as I've ever seen anybody wear. So it was terrific.
It might say something nice, not really that nice, but I'll work around to it. You know what? The one thing we want from our teams out here is just don't be boring, right? Well, Cal has gone into the ACC and certainly not been boring. They are winless in the ACC, but they are winless by a grand total of, I believe it's 9 points. They lost by 5, no, 10 points, I believe. They lost by 5 to Florida State. They lost by 1 to Miami. They lost by 2 to Pittsburgh, and they lost by 1 to North Carolina State. This past weekend, they missed a 28-yard field goal with 1.5 minutes left. Could have given them the lead in that one. Oh, no, couldn't do it. They believe they missed a late 2-pointer against Pittsburgh. We saw them cough up a 25-point lead against Miami. They have been at least wildly entertaining. Heartbreaking, but wildly entertaining. And they've given us the Calgarhythm. They've given us the Jaden Ott song, O-T-T-T-O-G-O, and he didn't get to play, so it became O-T-T-N-O-G-O. But go, Cal. Good job at least being competitively bad.
All right, I'm going to say something nice about Oklahoma fan, at least one of them. A friend of mine does not want to be revealed as his name. He prefer to be called Deep Sooner. It's a tough time to be Deep Sooner. Not going so well out there, Norman. Revenue, Pat, right? They got revenue.
Revenue.
They got revenues, fired their coordinator. They can afford it. Other than that, they ain't got much. They lose 35-9 to South Carolina. This whole SEC excitement, not so exciting anymore. Program's in disarray. No one knows where it's going. But in college football, there are two things that are exciting. One is when your team wins, and the other is when your rivals lose. And so this is what Deep Sooner decided to text me today at 11:24 out of nowhere, because he just needed to get excited. That his two most bitter rivals, Texas, lost to Georgia, and Lincoln Riley's USC lost to Maryland, as we discussed earlier. And so, at least as bad as the beatdowns have gotten out in Oklahoma, he's got this going for him. I don't drink, he texts me. But if I did, I would have poured myself one and then sat on my couch and giggled at the slow exposure of the sham that is Lincoln Riley. And Sark moving to 1-3 versus top 15 teams in the, quote, Texas is back, unquote, era. And then I would wash the memory of OU's little Giants attempt to play football earlier in the afternoon.
Yeah. Brent Venables has been exposed much more fast than Lincoln Riley. But, you know, I get his point.
But at least you got that, Sooner fan. Your old coach left you for a new guy, and he didn't turn out so good. Ain't going so well over there. Could be divorce papers. And your local rival fattened up on bad teams, including you, by the way. But that's all right. So at least you had that going for you. And I think it's an important part of college football that we should say something nice about. The power of spite.
It is a powerful energy force in college football. Spite and pettiness.
Yeah. Yep. So at least we got that. All right. We'll be back next week. It continues. It's just getting crazy. Please subscribe, share us on social media. We'll be back Tuesday. We'll talk to you.